Good day. Today is Saturday, 4th July 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me first remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. But far more importantly, let me first of all take this opportunity to congratulate the people of the United States, all Americans who are watching this program, on the 250th anniversary of the United States, of their country, one of the great nations of the world, a country which is 250 years old, at least in terms, if you take its founding from 1776, the Declaration of Independence, which I do. The American people during the Revolutionary War had to fight a bitter struggle to gain their independence. Much of American history since then has been difficult. There's been the Civil War, there's been the Depression, there's been many other things. But America has always been there. Its constitution has prevailed up to now against all political challenges. Its system of government remains, in my opinion, stable. It has achieved extraordinary things in terms of culture and economics and politics. There are many, many things that Americans deserve to be proud of. And for that reason, I extend to you my warmest congratulations on this day. Well, now I think I must proceed with the news, the information that's taking place in the world. And I'm going to start with the conflict in Ukraine, where yesterday, for the first time this year, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, did what he did several times in the second half of last year. He put on a military uniform, attended a military headquarters, which, for the record, I think was mostly a prop. Just saying, I don't think it was in any actual location where any military headquarters actually exist. But that is completely unimportant. He attended a military headquarters. He received a detailed report about the military situation on the Ukrainian battlefields from the overall commander of the Russian forces who are engaged in the special military operation, General Gerasimov, who also happens to be the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces. He received reports from commanders of groups of forces and also battlefield commanders. And he was told the big news of the day, which is that the city of Konstantinovka, 80,000 people before the war, a major industrial center in Donbass, a city once famous for its glass industry. I read a report a few days ago that said that the ruby stars that decorate the Kremlin towers, that light up, in fact, the Kremlin towers, and which are a very distinctive feature of the Moscow skyline, that these ruby stars were actually manufactured in Konstantinovka. I read that. I don't actually know whether that is true, but I presume it is. Anyway, Konstantinovka, once a city of 80,000 people, has now, according to Gerasimov, the Russian Defense Ministry and the commanders on the ground, been captured by the Russian armed forces. Now, I say been captured by the Russian armed forces, but if you drill carefully into the transcripts, the actual transcript that the Kremlin has published of the discussion, you will find squirreled away an admission that there are probably still some Ukrainian troops in the city, some of them perhaps hiding in basements or buildings. In other words, the clear-up operation in Konstantinovka is still underway, but I personally have no doubt that the story that Putin was given, the report that Putin was given, that Konstantinovka is under secure Russian control is true. And in fact, in order perhaps to confirm its truth, Putin was also shown a video showing Russian troops in many parts of Konstantinovka, raising Russian flags and victory flags, which are, of course, based on the Soviet victory flag. Anyway, we see pictures of them all over Konstantinovka, including in its northeasterly positions, precisely the places, in other words, where one had reason to suppose and expect that the Ukrainians would make their last organized stand. I have said in various programs on this channel, and I repeat again, my own belief that Konstantinovka has been under effective Russian control for several weeks. Clearly, the Russians were engaged in a major clearing operation in the city. I suspect that what has now happened is that this is now so close to a conclusion that it was felt that there was no reason to delay the announcement of Konstantinovka's capture any further. And alongside the big news about the capture of Konstantinovka, Gerasimov and the other military officials that Putin met and spoke to in this, as I said, rather staged meeting. I suspect it was a very staged meeting. And by the way, that's not a criticism. That is how I would expect it to be. Anyway, they also reported to him about the overall situation in all sorts of other places. Gerasimov said that Liman, of course he calls it by its old Soviet name, Krasny Liman, is about to be captured. The fighting there has almost ended. Probably we will get an announcement tomorrow or maybe in a few days that Liman has or is also about to fall. And we were told all sorts of things about other places where fighting is taking place, that the salient, the Ukrainian position east on the east bank of the Oskol River, south of Kupiansk, is about to be eliminated, that the Ukrainians are trying another counterattack on Russian positions in the city of Kupiansk. By the way, the way Gerasimov spoke about the situation in Kupiansk, he clearly was conveying the impression that there was never a moment after the Russians captured Kupiansk in the early autumn of 2025 when they didn't retain control of it. I'm talking now about the town on the west bank of the Oskol River. I appreciate that this remains very controversial and fiercely disputed by many people, but certainly that was the impression Gerasimov gave. I am not going to explore this topic in this program. But anyway, Gerasimov spoke about renewed Ukrainian counterattacks in Kupiansk, all intended to foster the impression that the situation in Kupiansk is still unresolved in some way. Gerasimov said that that would be untrue, and he spoke about heavy Ukrainian losses in relation to these counterattacks. And an awful lot was also said about the state of the fighting along the northern border, Ukraine's northern border, the part of the border that covers Kharkiv and Sumy regions within Ukraine, and which borders on the Russian regions of Belgorod, Kursk, and Bryansk. General Nikiforov, who is now the commander of Group of Forces North, spoke about the extensive progress of his forces and the fact that they are now just 8 kilometres from the city of Sumy itself. It was all purportedly about creating buffer zones to protect Russia, the Russian border, from Ukrainian attacks. But as I will discuss shortly, it was fairly clear to me that, in fact, in this region, the Russians are indeed thinking and planning about more. Anyway, let's first begin by talking a little bit more about Konstantinovka. Now, there is a claim which is out there that the Battle of Konstantinovka has taken a very long time. It's a town of 80,000 people, that the Russians needed around 6 months to capture Konstantinovka. And, well, there is some validity to that claim. Back in the late winter of 2025, the commander of Group of Forces South, the Russian force which has now captured Konstantinovka, gave the impression, or in fact told Putin, he didn't give the impression, he told Putin that something like, I believe, 50% of the buildings, the residential buildings in Konstantinovka, were already under Russian control. And from memory, he seemed to be saying that he expected the whole of Konstantinovka to fall under Russian control by the middle of January. So that was what the Russian commander said at that time. Putin, as I remember, told him to stop what he was saying. Putin told him that the Russian army does not work to those sort of timetables. And obviously, we're now in July, not in January, and it's taken a great deal longer than the commander of Group of Forces South suggested for the Russians to capture Konstantinovka. My own personal view is that it's a misconception that the battle for Konstantinovka has really taken that long. The Battle of Donbass, the entire region of Donbass, which began in earnest in May 2022 with the Russian captures of Volnovakha and then subsequently Mariupol, well, that has indeed been an extremely protracted affair. And what that has involved is the capture of multiple places, many of them heavily fortified by the Russians in this very dense and rather difficult landscape. And some of the events which some will say were part of the battle of Konstantinovka did indeed begin in late 2025. But putting aside the really rather extraordinary claims made by the commander of Group of Forces South in that briefing he gave to Putin back in the late winter of 2024, which come, by the way, with an enormous question mark and do make one wonder what that was all about. In my opinion, the real Battle of Konstantinovka began in May. The Russian offensive on the front lines, the spring offensive, began in April. It then began to crank up in May. In May, May was the month when the Russians began to focus on the capture of Konstantinovka itself. In fact, and in practice, Ukrainian defences in Konstantinivka once the full weight of the Russian military was directed at them began to crumble fairly quickly. And at least according to Marat Khairulin, the Russian war reporter, whom I've talked about many times on this programme, it was as a result of the big advances by the Russians in Konstantinivka that in June the Russians began the serious effort to capture Liman in the north. Liman, the town which is closer to Slavyansk, the northernmost part of the Ukrainian fortified area, remaining fortified area in Donbass. So if we take May as the point where the fighting in Konstantinivka really started in earnest, well, then it didn't take so long after all. But perhaps all of these talks about timetables is a little irrelevant. The fact is that Konstantinivka has indeed now been captured. As I said about that, I have no doubt at all. And as Putin and Gerasimov discussed with each other, that means that the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinivka conurbation, which is the Slavyansk, Konstantinivka, Kramatorsk fortified area, is no longer that any longer. It is now the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation and fortified area. And as several people, including, by the way, myself, have done, over the course of the discussion that took place yesterday, Gerasimov sort of told Putin that he too expected that the two remaining cities, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, would be captured much more quickly and much more easily than Konstantinivka itself was. Konstantinivka is a part of this fortified line. Its loss compromises the integrity of the entire fortified line and makes it much more vulnerable. The loss of Liman, well, it is announced by the Russians at some point, presumably this week, will highlight again the extent to which the entire front line, the entire fortified line, which enables the Ukrainians to claim that they still have a presence in Donbass, that entire fortified line will also crumble, and crumble very quickly. So anyway, that's the situation relating to Konstantinivka that we were given. And of course, we had the discussions between Putin and the various commanders. Putin spoke about the fact that some commanders deserve promotions. He spoke about how some of the battlefield commanders now should be inducted for training into the Russian General Staff Academy. In other words, prepared for higher command training. But Gerasimov immediately interjected that yes, this should happen, but it must only happen after the capture of Slavyansk. In other words, the remainder of the fortified line in the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. So Putin and Gerasimov were clearly in agreement about that. And as I said, they discussed the situation in other parts of the battlefield as well. And again, I found the most interesting the part that discussed the situation in northeastern Ukraine. Putin spoke about how what he described as Ukrainian terror attacks, which appeared to extend to drone attacks on Russian territory, would cause the Russians to expand their buffer zone. And, well, I got the sense that the buffer zone that he was talking about might come to be expanded, well, far beyond the limit of any buffer zone. Because I noticed that he also, at one point, said that all of this territory that the Russians are in the process of capturing in Sumy and Kharkiv region is Russian, historically Russian, but actually Russian territory as well, even though Russia and Putin himself continue to recognize this territory as part of Ukraine. Now, given this comment by Putin, I wonder whether there is any set of circumstances whereby Putin now would ever agree to a withdrawal of Russian troops from Kharkiv and Sumy region. And given that, in my opinion, Putin is far and away the most moderate figure left in the Russian political system, whether there is any senior Russian official or successor or possible successor to Putin who would consider withdrawing from territory which even Vladimir Putin now says is and always has been historically Russian. My guess is that the more territory the Russians capture, the less likely they are to give it up at any time, whether as part of a settlement, a diplomatic settlement, or otherwise. If things develop to the point where the cities of Sumy and Kharkiv are captured by the Russian army, which we are probably still some time from, at least in the case of Kharkiv, but which is now beginning to appear as at least a possibility over the time horizon. Well, then, I get to say it straightforwardly, I cannot imagine any circumstance where the Russians are going to give up Sumy and Kharkiv, the cities, and they will be indefinitely lost to Ukraine or to whatever remains of Ukraine. And I noticed that Putin made a comparison between Konstantinovka and Sumy. He seemed to suggest that these two towns are of comparable size, at any rate in terms of the numbers of buildings that make up them. I'm not sure, by the way, that he's right about that. My understanding is that Sumy is significantly bigger than Konstantinovka, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, Putin talked about that, and he did seem to me to be at least contemplating in his mind circumstances where the city of Sumy might indeed come under Russian control. And if Sumy comes under Russian control, I would have thought that Kharkiv, obviously a much bigger place, must also be on the Russian agenda as well. And here General Nikiforov, the commander of Group of Forces North, had some very interesting things to say. He said that work in expanding the buffer zone on the border is going well. He said that work in countering Ukrainian drone strikes and other attacks on Russia is proving more complicated. Nikiforov's words here did seem to me to suggest that there might indeed be something in what some people have been saying, that the big Ukrainian drone strikes on Russia and on central Russia and on the city of Moscow specifically, were conducted from northeastern Ukraine, Russian military operations in northeastern Ukraine, the expansion of the buffer zone, the attacks on the gasoline stations, the filling stations, the gas filling stations along the highways in eastern Ukraine, that all of these things taken together were making it impossible for the Ukrainians to conduct, or make much more difficult for the Ukrainians to conduct, deep strikes with drones far into Russia, because the Russians are now getting alerts about the takeoff of these drones when they are launched from their launch sites in central Russia. And that gives the Russians around 2 or 3 hours to prepare for the 2 or 3 further hours, I should say, to prepare for the arrival of these drones. Anyway, Nikiforov spoke about that, and he also spoke about Russian advances in northeastern Kharkiv region around the town of Beli Kolodias. And, well, the overwhelming impression I got is that northeastern Ukraine is very, very much unfinished business for the Russians. A lot is indeed taking place there, and the footprint of the Russian army in this area is going to expand significantly over the next few months. And this puts aside the further possibility of a Russian advance into northeastern Ukraine, into Chernigov region, from Bryansk region, which I discussed at length in my program yesterday. So again, to repeat, if people in Kiev, people in the government there, and of course Western governments, West European governments, and the US government want to avoid these eventualities of a Russian advance into northeastern Ukraine, which will bring the Russian military dangerously close to the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. If Western governments want to stop that from happening, then perhaps they should think about doing two things: telling Zelensky to stop his drone and missile offensive against Russia, which of course he's not going to do, and telling Zelensky that the situation is now such that he must make peace, or if he doesn't make peace, he must step aside to enable someone else on behalf of Ukraine to do so. Now, I say that, I saw an opinion poll, the result of an opinion poll, which has appeared. I'm not sure who carried it out, and I'm not sure how valid its results are, but it claims that 66% of Ukrainians want Ukraine to begin negotiations right away to try to agree a peace settlement of the conflict with Russia. Of course, that doesn't in itself tell us very much. It doesn't tell us what, if any, concessions this 66% of Ukrainians are prepared to make to bring the war to an end. Are they prepared to give up Donbass? Are they prepared to give up Zaporozhye and Kherson regions? Are they prepared for Ukraine to embrace again neutral status? Are they prepared, perhaps, to give up the dream of Ukrainian membership of the European Union? I suspect that opinion on these questions amongst that 66% who want peace, or at least want negotiations to achieve peace, opinions are still divided, though I am going to make a further guess that those who want peace at the price of accepting Russian terms is quietly growing. But certainly, if you believe this opinion poll, then there is definitely a constituency in Ukraine that favours peace talks and would want to sit down with the Russians and explore the possibility of a negotiated peace, which, of course, is not what Zelensky wants to do. Indeed, to repeat a point I have made many times, way back in the early autumn of 2022, he passed a decree forbidding any negotiations by any Ukrainian official with the Russians at all. He has subsequently claimed that he himself is exempted by the terms of this decree so that he himself can conduct negotiations with the Russians. He has undermined the force of his own decree by following intense pressure from Donald Trump, sending peace negotiators to meet with the Russians three times in Istanbul, twice in Abu Dhabi, and once in Geneva over the course of 2025. But those talks, as we know, led nowhere. And Zelensky also said at the end of 2025 that since the Russians are not prepared to accept his demand for an unconditional ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, he sees no point or purpose in any further negotiations with the Russians at all. Whenever Zelensky speaks, as he often does, by the way, at least towards Western audiences, about getting the Russians to sit down at the table to negotiate, it's important to understand that what precedes that, what must precede that, according to Zelensky's agenda, is an unconditional ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, followed by talks based on the framework that he set out way back in 2022, his so-called peace plan of that period, which basically requires a Russian withdrawal from all Ukrainian territory, Russian payment of reparations, and Russia's agreement that senior Russian officials, civilian and military, presumably extending all the way up to Putin himself, agree to subject themselves to war crimes trial, prosecutions. In other words, for Zelensky, negotiations and peace, in his language, translates in normal language as a demand for Russia's unconditional capitulation, which, given the facts on the ground, with the capture of places like Konstantinovka and the pending capture by the Russians of the rest of Donbass, is, of course, completely absurd. But to repeat again the point I've just made, what needs to happen if the situation for Ukraine is not going to get very much worse very soon with the fall of northeastern Ukraine, the possible capture of Sumy region, of Sumy, of the city of Sumy, and the city of Kharkiv, and perhaps even Chernigov, if all of those rumours I was talking about yesterday are true. If that is to be avoided now, then negotiations to try and achieve a peace, I mean real negotiations, negotiations conducted in good faith, based on what the Russians say are the existing battlefield realities, should start immediately. Because delaying negotiations is going to make the situation worse. And Putin's point about Kharkiv and Sumy being Russian land ought to act as an alarm bell. Of course, it won't. In the West, we're still very much in the grip of the current narrative that the Ukrainians have wrested back the initiative from the Russians on the battlefronts. And the Battle of Konstantinivka, the capture of the single largest inhabited settlement in Donbass since the Russian capture of Mariupol in June 2022, the capture of Konstantinivka has gone almost completely unreported in the British media today. The BBC, the big mainstream newspapers, I couldn't find a single reference to this fact in any of them. Reuters, the news agency, did report it, or to be more precise, they reported the Russian claim that Konstantinivka has been captured by the Russians. But in this really rather garbled article that Reuters published, that claim, that reporting of the Russian claim to have captured Konstantinivka is bracketed with all the usual claims about the Ukrainians wresting back control of the initiative on the battlefronts, the Ukrainians having slowed the Russians to a crawl, the Ukrainians having captured more territory from the Russians than the Ukrainians have lost to the Russians over the course of the fighting since the spring, the increasing effectiveness of Ukrainian drone strikes on Russia, and all of that. Anyway, the Reuters article smudges the message about the fall of Konstantinivka and, of course, does not recognise Konstantinivka's importance, even though, as I well remember, it was Reuters itself about 2 weeks ago that published an article that said that Konstantinivka was the gateway to the rest of Ukrainian-controlled Donbass. Of course, that article by Reuters of 2 weeks ago somewhat played down the situation. It said that, yes, the fighting was starting to take place around Konstantinivka, but the Ukrainians were still basically holding their positions there. As I remember, there were further articles about the fight in Konstantinivka that appeared subsequently in the British media. There was one that put the total number of Russian troops in Konstantinivka at around 150, based on a comment made by a Ukrainian general. There was and has been a huge amount of denial, both about the importance of Konstantinivka and about the true direction of the battle. And one senses that, at least in Britain, there is now an intense unwillingness to report this story or to understand this story, because it is so in conflict with the recent narrative of Ukrainian success that it's difficult for media outlets in Britain and no doubt elsewhere in the West to make much sense of it. In the West, by the way, in Ukraine too, people need to wake up out of this daydream, this idea that the war in Ukraine is going well for Ukraine, that it is the Russians who are on the back foot and the Ukrainians who are advancing. I saw this morning, again in the British media, that some brave soul has actually bet £300,000 that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, will be out of his job by the end of this year. Well, presumably, the person who has made this bet is basing it on all of these stories about Ukrainian success in the battle, in the battles that are taking place in Ukraine, and all of the stories about the Russian economy being in crisis and the effect of the drone attacks on Ukraine. If this person loses his money, as I expect he will, then of course he will have a lot of grounds for complaint about the way in which he has been misled. Well, perhaps one can have some sympathy for him, but for Western governments, one should have no sympathy whatsoever, given the amount of resources they are giving to Zelensky and to Ukraine to conduct the war. It seems to me that it is absolutely their duty, their obligation, to find out what is really going on the Ukrainian battlefields and to make their decisions accordingly. Now, on the topic of Konstantinovka, even if you wish, if you're a Westerner and you wish to believe that Russian claims of total control of Konstantinovka are wrong, well, you should ask themselves the question, how in that case are the Russians able to produce film and pictures of Russian soldiers all over Konstantinovka raising their flags? It's a big place. Maybe there are still Ukrainian troops there, but at the very least, you should be asking questions and you should be trying to find out. Well, Konstantinovka is another key place that the Russians have captured over the course of this grueling battle for Donbass. Mariupol was the first, Bakhmut was the second, then we had Avdeyevka, places like Krasnogorovka, Kurakhovo, Selidovo, Ugleda, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Toretsk. Now we have Konstantinovka. Before long, we're going to have Liman too. All of these places are towns, some of them are cities. All of these places are not just villages or small hamlets, as sometimes people assume. All of them formed a fortified belt that the Russians are now reaching the uttermost edge of. Whence the two big remaining places, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, fall. And I agree with Gerasimov and Khairulin that this is likely to take less time than many people think. the Donbass, Ukraine's, formerly Ukraine's richest, most industrialized region, its most populous region, the region with the strongest fortified positions, the region that the Ukrainian army has bled white to defend, the region where the entire Ukraine conflict began, will have been lost. And what will it all have been for? And what has Ukraine and the West achieved by fighting for Donbass so long? We have a much more powerful and much bigger Russian army than we used to. And we have a much weaker and more fragile Ukraine than we once did. Anyway, I am not going to talk much more about all of this. We will have more developments, I am sure, on the front lines before very long. I expect that, as I said, over the next few days, Lyman will fall. There is apparently about to start the battle for Nikolaevka. Putin, of course, thinks it has already begun, which would be the start of the battle for Slavyansk-Kramatorsk. I suspect that before long, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk are also going to be cut off from resupply, and there'll be a cauldron there. Anyway, we will have an awful lot more news from the Donbass and from Ukraine fairly shortly. Anyway, I want to now return to the topic of the war in the sky, because last night, on the eve of the NATO summit meeting in Ankara, and by the way, I may as well say that I think one of the reasons why the Russians took the decision to hold this meeting and to announce the fall of Konstantinovka yesterday, a fall which, in my opinion, took place some weeks ago, is because they wanted it to be made, they wanted this announcement to be made immediately prior to the NATO meeting in Ankara, which will, of course, be attended by Donald Trump. Anyway, I wanted to say something about the drone wars, because, again, last night, Ukraine launched more drone and apparently missile strikes too, with Flamingo missiles at targets in Russia. And according to some reports, Ukraine used around 400 drones over the course of this attack. And the town of Votkinsk was again attacked. This is the location of a major industrial plant, a huge Russian industrial plant, which makes ballistic missiles, including Iskander missiles. The Ukrainians have attacked it at least once before, and there are reports that a Ukrainian missile actually hit the plant on that occasion. And the Ukrainians also launched a further drone attack on St. Petersburg, with some reports suggesting that the drones were launched from ships in the Gulf of Finland. Anyway, the key thing about this other big attack, which looks again as if it was timed to coincide with the NATO meeting in Ankara, is that this big combined drone missile strike by Ukraine appears to have been, well, essentially unsuccessful. It seems that no missile or drone reached Votkinsk at all. No damage was done to the factory at all. There are pictures of some kind of electrical facility somewhere in Russia being on fire. The facility does not look very big, and I guess this was some kind of exchange station that makes up Russia's, by the way, gigantic electrical grid. And the drones that were launched against St. Petersburg, they appear to have managed to create a fire in one tank in a refinery in St. Petersburg. Though again, the information about the extent of this attack remains somewhat patchy, at least for me. But overall, one can't say that large numbers of drones got through or did a huge amount of damage. Some Ukrainian drones also attacked facilities in and around the city of Belgorod, which of course lies very close to the Ukrainian border. And for several hours, the lighting in Belgorod was switched off, and it is likely that some damage was done. But Belgorod is a frontline city, like Crimea, and sad to say, it has experienced many attacks, and because of the short distances, it's unsurprising that some drones or even missiles get through. But deeper inside Russia, in the great cities, in the Urals industrial region, in the industrial regions of the Volga, in the oil and gas fields of Western Siberia, in the Siberian industrial regions as well. Well, in all of those places, no drones appear to have penetrated whatsoever. I am starting to come round to the view that the big drone strike on Moscow, the one that attracted so much attention, the one where apparently the drones were dropping kerosene packages in order to create the impression of large fires and smoke columns. I'm coming round to the view that that particular drone attack was a one-off, that the Ukrainians have been unable to repeat the media success of that particular drone attack. Something happened over the course of that attack which meant that the Russian air defences were caught napping, so that some drones, some say out of 500 Ukrainian drones, just 7 drones, but again, I'm not there. Some drones got through and did a certain amount of damage to one refinery. But since then, the various follow-up attacks that the Ukrainians have been making have been unsuccessful. Presumably, the new commander of Russia's air defense forces has carried out some sort of reorganization, and probably the air defense systems that Putin was talking about in his recent statements are now coming into service in sufficient numbers to make the difference and are providing the necessary level of protection against the Ukrainian drones. I understand that the big Russian state companies, Rostec, Rosatom, Rosneft, all of those, and some of the big private companies too, that they have been encouraged by the Russian government to undertake private protection measures to protect their buildings and their facilities. And that includes enlisting guards who are trained to shoot down drones and buying heavy caliber machine guns and radars, small radars to track the drones. And it may be that this is making some difference too. But anyway, perhaps it's too early to say, and Ukrainian drone attacks on Crimea in particular do still continue, though I'm hearing that the situation there also has been gradually stabilized. Electric power has basically been restored. There may be cutoffs from time to time, but we're not looking at anything like a permanent blackout. And the situation with gasoline in Crimea is apparently beginning to ease as well. Again, I'm not there, but I've received and read reports from people who seem to be saying this. And the Russians also seem to be profiling various weapons that are apparently going to be distributed to the frontline soldiers in order to counter the first-person view drones that the Ukrainians use on the battlefronts. The main way up to now that the Russians have used to counter FPV drones has been to come after and kill the drone operators. FPV drones have to be operated close to the front lines, so the Russians track where the operators are and hunt them. And apparently this has definitely taken a significant toll of Ukrainian drone operators. But apparently there are now increasing numbers of tools being distributed to fight the FPV drones for the infantry to use to defend themselves against the drones. I spoke, I think, about a day or so ago about the small radar sets, the battlefield radars, that are being supplied to the soldiers in order to track the drones. And apparently, the Kalashnikov concern has produced a new rifle round that can be fired from Kalashnikov rifles, which the Russians say is all but guaranteed to shoot down FPV drones. I've heard that soldiers are very reluctant to expose themselves to shoot down FPV drones, but perhaps there's some tactic behind it, which I don't know. Anyway, to repeat again, I believe that over the next few weeks and months, we are going to start to see increasing decline in the effectiveness, certainly of the Ukrainian FPV drones on the Ukrainian battlefields. The heyday of the drone is ending on the Ukrainian battlefields much sooner than I think many Western commentators expect. Anyway, there we go. Konstantinovka has fallen. More places will follow. The Russians continue to advance. They seem to be getting on top of the Ukrainian drone attacks on their own country. Maybe they're coming soon to the point of being able to counter the Ukrainian drone attacks on their forces on the battlefronts, and the Russian offensive continues to gain pace. In Russia itself, Putin's authority, as far as I can see, is unaffected by all that has been happening. And in June, according to the PMI data, the economy again continued to grow. So anyway, that is the situation in the war. Now, I want here to discuss something that is very related to the war, but which is at the same time somewhat distinct from it, which is this whole discussion that has been taking place in the West about the development in the West of a military industrial economy and the idea that in Europe at least, increased spending on the arms industry is going to lead to reindustrialization and to some sort of economic boom in Western Europe, transforming the general decline, economic decline, that pretty much everyone now accepts is taking place in Europe. Military spending supposedly is going to reverse it. Well, I've been reading a study that has been published by something called the TFF Transnational Foundation and by a writer called Jan Oberg. And I should say that I follow these writers fairly closely. I don't always agree with what they say, but in what they say here, I think they're spot on right. They've done a study which says that there has been no historic study of the supposed economic benefits of weapons production in peacetime that shows that it provides the economic benefits for the wider population that is often being claimed. And I know for a fact that that is true. But it says something else which is truly extraordinary, which is that apparently there has not been a single study anywhere in Europe about what the economic consequences of higher defence spending on the European economy are going to be. And, well, it says this. It says that despite the largest rearmament wave since 1945, not a single major European research institute has produced a study comparing military and civilian multipliers. The silence is not limited to Scandinavia, it is continental. In the Nordic countries, institutes such as FOI in Sweden, DIIS in Denmark, NUPI and FFI in Norway, PRIO in Oslo, CMS in Copenhagen, and SIRPRI in Stockholm publish threat analyses, strategic doctrine, Russia assessments, NATO capability studies, and industrial policy briefs. But none of them has ever published a systematic comparison of the economic benefits of military versus civilian spending. The same appears across Europe. Germany's leading economic institutes, DIW Berlin, IFO Munich, and the Kiel Institute, have produced extensive work on fiscal policy, industrial strategy, and public investment. Yet none has examined the relative multipliers of defence and civilian spending. In France, institutions such as France Stratégie and CEPI analyse competitiveness, innovation and public finance sustainability, but they have never evaluated the economic consequences of rearmament. Brussels-based think tanks like Bruegel, which routinely assess EU-level industrial and fiscal policy, have not addressed the economic trade-offs of large-scale defence expansion. The Netherlands CPB, one of Europe's most respected policy analysis bodies, has never modelled the opportunity costs of shifting resources from civilian to military sectors. The same silence extends to Oxford Economics and Chatham House in the United Kingdom, to Istituto Affari Internazionali in Italy, to the Polish Institute of International Affairs, and the major economics departments of European universities. Even the European Union's own institutions, the European Commission, the European Defence Agency, the European Investment Bank, and the European Court of Auditors have not produced a single study comparing the economic returns of military and civilian investment. They analysed defence procurement, industrial capacity, and budgetary compliance, but never the fundamental question: is military spending economically inferior or superior to civilian spending? Europe produces threat assessments, strategic doctrines, capability roadmaps, and geopolitical narratives. But it does not produce multiplier comparisons, employment effect studies, consumption effect analyses, distributional impact evaluations, opportunity cost modelling, or welfare economics assessments of defence spending. And then this article finishes. The silence is not accidental. It illustrates that state-financed research institutes do not venture into anything that could be critical of the massive, uniform groupthink rearming of Europe. And this is absolutely true. I have heard of many, indeed probably most, but not all of these institutes, but I've never seen a single study come out of a single one. I've never seen discussions about this in the media in the West, the part of the media, the European media that I read. Lord Robert Skidelsky, who was, of course, the great biographer of J.M. Keynes, and who had, as a result of his peerage, a voice in the British Parliament, in the House of Lords, talked about this many times, but he was almost a lone voice doing so. And tragically, and very sadly, he has now passed away. There is an absolute, extraordinary, echoing silence across Europe about all of this. Nor, so far as I know, has there been a proper study of whether Chancellor Merz's debt-based spending spree on weapons production is going to either produce more weapons or is going to either strengthen or weaken the German economy. Of course, my view of this matter is well known. I believe it is going to weaken it. But if there is a study that looks into this question in Germany itself and says that it's going to strengthen the long-term future of the German economy and explains why and goes into the weeds and the details and explains why, well, then again, I don't know about it. And please tell me of it so that I can read it. This extraordinary silence on this topic, on this massively important subject, is both extraordinary and it is extremely sinister. One of the biggest economic decisions in modern European history is being taken, and nobody is looking at the economic consequences. This silence is, by the way, in no way unusual. After it became increasingly clear in 2022 that many of the assumptions that were held by European, especially, by the way, American policymakers, about the resilience of the Russian economy or lack of it, and the Russian economy's vulnerability to sanctions. Well, when it turned out that none of those assumptions were true. I made, in my own way, using the very limited resources at my disposal, I tracked down as many people as I could who I knew had some knowledge of Russia. I'm talking about Westerners now, people who actually worked in the Russian economy, the oil industry, the mechanical engineering industry, who had knowledge about universities, about the way in which finances were managed in Russia. I mean people who have hands-on experience of all of this. I don't mean people who work in universities and institutes and know about the Russian economy in a purely abstract sense. Anyway, I tracked as many of these people as I could down. As I said, I couldn't obviously reach to that many. And I asked each and every one of them, some of them people who I certainly would have expected Western governments to want to consult before they took the enormous sanctions decisions against Russia that they began to take in February 2022. Did anybody from any Western government contact you? Did they seek your advice? Did they seek your information about what the effect on the Russian economy of what we are planning to do? Did anybody contact you? And without exception, every one of them said to me, no. I subsequently learned that in relation to the decision to freeze the Russian central bank assets, the Federal Reserve Board in the United States was not spoken to or consulted either. Incredibly, not only was there no discussion about the potential impact of sanctions on Russia, no wider discussion about the potential impact of sanctions on Russia made prior to the sanctions announcements in February and March 2022. But as I have now come to believe, there was no wider assessment or research done into what the effect of the sanctions might be on the Western economies, on the European economies as well. It was very clear to us on the Duran. We actually said this after the initial sanctions announcements in February 2022, that the decisions in particular to shut down the gas supplies from Russia would trigger in Germany and ultimately in the rest of Europe as well, a process of deindustrialization. We, Alex and I, who do not have any of the resources that any of these institutes or Western governments have, well, we said that, and I don't think anybody today would dispute the accuracy of what we said. Did anybody amongst the people who made those decisions, those economic decisions, those enormously important economic decisions in the West, did they consult more widely? Did they conduct any research? Did they ask what the long-term effect would be on the Western economies of an economic war against Russia, especially if the assumptions that the Russians would fold turned out to be wrong? Well, again, from my knowledge, I don't think that a single such assessment was made. The problem is that Western decision-making, ever since February 2022, and arguably from some time before, has been made by a very small group of people who have little practical experience of industry matters who do not want to hear opinions that contradict their own assumptions. I heard, for example, how the German economics minister, Robert Habeck, the economics minister in Olaf Scholz's government, who was the major champion of the economic war in Russia, I've heard of the scathing way he would respond to any pushback against his ideas from officials within the German economics ministry. I've also heard that the European Commission president, Ursula von der Leyen, is also equally resistant to advice that contradicts her firmly settled views on all of these issues. And as I said, this very small group of people who exercise extraordinary power and control, including narrative power and control, are able to make their decisions and to enforce them, and have somehow achieved the ability, as we've seen, to shut down all alternative discussion and debate. I recently learnt of one very prominent commentator on Russian matters, who is, by the way, strongly critical of President Putin's government and of President Putin, who believes that President Putin's decision to stop the SMO was a mistake, but who also thinks that certain Western policies towards Russia are misjudged. I've heard that this person, who I consider to be, by the way, one of the best qualified commentators on Russian issues, is now finding it increasingly difficult to get his ideas published, and that certain journals are now simply refusing to publish him. This is disastrous. It is completely out of control. We've already seen the disastrous effect that those decisions made in February 2022 and subsequently in terms of sanctions against Russia, we've seen the disastrous effects that they have had. Now we're about to launch into a new set of equally momentous decisions, a demand for a massive increase in military spending, which is going to be ratified at the NATO meeting in Ankara. There's been no studies done about this. Nobody is looking at what the economic effects, the effects on the citizens of Europe, what those are going to be. It's just full steam ahead, even as the iceberg lies there in wait. Now, once upon a time, as I very well remember, policy in the West was made very differently. President Kennedy and President Nixon, two presidents about whom I know a certain amount, I know used to consult very widely and used to make sure that they were very thoroughly informed about all aspects of a problem before they made a decision. They were very different people, had very different outlooks, and by the way, they detested each other. But in that, at least, they had something in common. Today, in the West, we have lost that skill. Instead, we persist in making bold gestures based on stories that have no actual sense or purpose. A few days ago, Reuters, the British news agency, published a report about how China is supposedly providing military training to the Russian military. And the German government, Friedrich Merz's government, reacted very negatively to this story, and they called in a representative of the Chinese embassy, and they said to the Chinese diplomat how very wrong this was and how it had to be construed as China providing military support to Russia to conduct the special military operation. Well, I went to this article by Reuters, and I did so because the story, as published in much of the media, made no sense. Why would the Russians, who have by now acquired enormous battlefield experience in the Ukrainian battlefields, why would they need to obtain training from the Chinese, who have no battlefield experience at all? If anybody should be training anyone, it should be the Russians training the Chinese, not vice versa. Well, it turned out that the actual story was completely different. It was based on the fact that the Russian and Chinese militaries conducted a joint training exercise, which is a matter of public knowledge, and it appeared to be connected to how to deal with problems in the event that there was a nuclear or a kind of war involving weapons of mass destruction. A disturbing thing, by the way, and it does make one wonder how the Russians and the Chinese feel about the global situation, if they feel that they need to train together and plan together to deal with a conflict of that kind. And it's clear that the Chinese have thought more about this than the Russians, which is interesting as well, by the way, and that the Chinese have more technical equipment looking at this question than the Russians. And it was also clear from the Reuters article that this was part of a long sequence of training exercises carried out by the Russian and the Chinese militaries together, which are fully known about publicly. There is no secret at all about them. This story has nothing to do with the special military operation. The Russians are not obtaining training advice from the Chinese as to how they should win the war in Ukraine. But despite the fact that this story in Reuters is actually a non-story, it tells us nothing that we didn't know or couldn't have worked out. As I said, there are some things about it which are somewhat concerning, but they're not the things that Reuters wanted to highlight. Despite that, there's, well, coverage of it everywhere. It's been in Der Spiegel, it's in the British media, it's in all sorts of places, and of course it started with Reuters. Surely our media, our leaders ought to be talking about other things, about how to achieve peace in Europe, about the real cost of rearmament, about whether rearmament is even achievable, and what its real consequences would be, whether rearming is more likely to provoke the Russians than to deter them, and whether, if provoked, the Russians might find that actually the military volumes that the Europeans have by themselves produced are insufficient to enable the Europeans to stand up to the Russians in a head-to-head fight. Those are the topics that we ought to be discussing in the West. Of course, we're not discussing them. We allow this small group of very angry and very intense people to take full control of decisions and policy. The Russians are again saying, by the way, that the Baltic states are providing air corridors for Ukrainian drones to use in order to conduct strikes against St. Petersburg and other places. An Estonian official said, all but confirmed that, didn't quite confirm it, but he said, it doesn't really matter if one or two drones, Ukrainian drones, fall on Estonian territory. The most important thing is that the Ukrainians are conducting their drone offensive against Russia. A drone offensive, which, as I've just said, is actually failing. We are prisoners, in effect, of these people's obsession. I say we, the people of Europe, are prisoners of these people's obsession. And it's time that we said stop. Anyway, with that, I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Today, as I said, is the 4th of July. I will, well, wish again all American viewers joy and peace and goodwill on this holiday. But today, I finish this program. I'll be back soon. Until then, have a very good day.